Welcome to the Dacus Report, hosted by Pacific Justice Institute founder and president Brad Dacus. For 25 years, PJI has counseled, represented, and defended people whose religious freedoms, parental rights, or sanctity of life have been obstructed or violated, all free of charge. We leave no one behind and level the playing field for Americans as they are subjected to the tyranny of the powerful. Now, here's Brad Dacus.
Welcome to the Dacus Report. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Brad Dacus, president of the Pacific Justice Institute.
Later on today's show, I'm going to be interviewing one of our attorneys who used to be an assistant district attorney to talk about an interesting case involving a teacher being forced to use pronouns and lie to parents and what we at PJI are doing about it. But first, I'd like to bring on to the program to talk about some other interesting cases. Emily Mimna, the attorney for PJI, who heads up our office there in Nevada. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Hi, thank you, Brad.
We've got some really interesting topics to discuss today. I know we're going to talk about something going on in Nevada dealing with parents' rights and also the EEOC effectively getting their hands slapped. But first, I want to talk about the Supreme Court of the United States update involving the FDA versus the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. It seems like it's not a total win, a total loss involving the FDA's desire to push out abortion pills, much to the objection of a number of red states. What's going on with this case?
Right. So as we all know, the FDA's job is supposed to be to keep people safe. But in effect, the agency has betrayed women and girls by relaxing standards and allowing what I think are basically at-home abortions without ongoing care by a doctor. And so a lawsuit was brought by four medical associations and four individual doctors challenging the FDA and saying, look, you dropped the ball. You're not, you know, you prioritized abortion at home and access for all, regardless of safety and health concerns. And so that case started a number of years ago. And of course, the FDA's, I would say, disregard for the health and safety of women and girls has been going on. It has been ongoing long before that. And so that lawsuit finally reached the Supreme Court. And on June 13, the Supreme Court issued its ruling. And, you know, it's funny because both sides seem to be claiming victory.
Right. They both are claiming victory. Okay, so let's start with, what did the FDA do to put women in harm?
Right. The FDA acknowledges, throughout the entirety of this litigation, the FDA acknowledges that 1 in 25 women who take this drug, it's called mifepristone, which is the at-home abortion, the abortion pill, what people call the abortion pill. 1 in 25 women who take that drug will end up in the emergency room, right? So that's kind of an undeniable fact.
Wow.
And what the FDA did was, after they approved the abortion pill, they continue to strip away the protections that were supposed to look after and safeguard women who were given these prescriptions. And there are lots of examples.
Yeah. I mean, I understand that originally only it was only deemed safe for women up to 7 weeks pregnant. Then they increased it to 10 weeks.
That's right. I mean, confirm that.
Yeah. And then the drug required a 3 in-person doctor visits. And now it's just reduced to just 1 visit. Then they reduced it to no doctor visits, no pre-screening, no post-screening for internal bleeding. I mean, good night. This is horrific. And this is the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, that we're supposed to rely upon to have integrity and character and for the health and safety of dealing with drugs. So what did the law violate? I understand the doctors asked the court to affirm the Fifth Circuit's decision to hold the FDA accountable for unlawfully failing to protect the health and safety of women and girls. What law was actually allegedly violated in this case?
Yeah, something called the Administrative Procedures Act, the APA, and you're going to hear a lot. You're going to hear that term coming up a lot through the end of this season, as they call it, at the Supreme Court, because, and I'm just going to, you know, highlight this for people. What we're seeing is a trend where the Biden administration tries to legislate through these federal agencies. So if you can't pass a law through Congress, you're trying to force unpopular laws onto the American public, you do it through these administrative agencies. And in this case, what we saw was the FDA strip away all those protections for women that you just listed, Brad, pulled all those away. And so these doctors got together and said, no, courts, then this is the judicial review mechanism through the APA. You need to hold this agency accountable and say, no, these procedures that we have for rulemaking by federal agencies were not followed. You push this pro-abortion, in-home DIY abortion plan onto the American public, and this needs to be stopped, and women and girls need to be protected.
Now, wait a minute. Okay, so Roe versus Wade was overturned with the Dobbs case. It was sent back to the states. I thought it was over, and now we're talking about a federal agency, the FDA, somehow managing to get involved again and start having a say on the abortion issue. It doesn't make sense. I thought this was brought back to the states.
That is a great question, and I think the Fifth Circuit agrees with you, Brad, as I think the Supreme Court may actually as well, once this case gets properly heard on the merits, and we'll get to that. But what we're seeing again are these federal agencies, which are, as you point out, under the executive branch, which is to say not the legislative branch, engaging in rulemaking. And time and again, when the administration can't get the laws they want passed through Congress, they do unconstitutional, in my opinion, unconstitutional shortcuts and try to force it on Americans, either through executive orders or, in this case, through rulemaking through federal agencies.
Yeah, it sounds to me like the executive branch to this agency is effectively legislating, basically completely going around Congress, which is a violation of the separation of powers. I mean, am I missing something here?
You are not. And in fact, I think the Supreme Court is going to agree with you very clearly in another case, which we don't need to go into the details of it. But the point is, the Supreme Court is positioned, I think, to make a big pronouncement saying that the reign of something called Chevron deference, which is to say the courts deferring to the interpretations of the laws by these administrative agencies, that's going to stop, because the interpretation of the laws is the job of the judicial branch. And the administrative agencies are in the executive branch. They shouldn't be legislating, and they shouldn't be interpreting the laws. And so I do think we're going to see a restoration of the proper, as you put it, Brad, the proper separation of powers. And this is all part of that narrative that is unfolding in this year's docket before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I really love the Supreme Court that we have, partly because of the three appointments by the former president between 2016 and 2020. It gives me a lot of hope, and I know they've already in the past have had some decisions that have pushed back on the bureaucrats to keep them in check, which we've been complaining about for decades now of abuse of bureaucratic powers and dominance and infringing on our freedoms and liberties. What did the FDA do in this case that was viewed as unlawful?
Right. The challenge was that the FDA, as you pointed out, systematically stripped away protections. So first, it started in 2016. There was another change in 2019, another change in 2021, where they said, okay, we're going to approve it, but only if you're 7 weeks pregnant. Then they said, okay, actually, if you're 10 weeks. Okay, but it's only safe if you have three doctor visits, including, you know, a visit before, so you can do an ultrasound. And not, you know, not as some pro-abortion activists say, not to dissuade women so much as for their health and safety, because if you have an ectopic pregnancy, these drugs are not safe. You need to have a visit after you take these pills to make sure you're not having bleeding internally. These are all for the safety and health of women. And sure enough, when so-called safety measures and safety guardrails get put in, they always get stripped away, because, and this is, I'm editorializing here, but when agencies take actions and say, oh, don't worry because we're putting in these guardrails, I think it is worth asking, why are we taking actions that require all these guardrails? We see the same thing with abortion, the same thing with assisted suicide. And so here, the FDA was called out.
Right. Well, I think it's worth pointing out that we at Pacific Justice Institute, where we defend the Constitution and basic fundamental rights of individuals, we've had to go through administrative agencies ourselves, which can be very frustrating for people. They say, hey, file a lawsuit, get this baby done. And yet we have to jump through the hoops in our litigation oftentimes because of administrative agencies say, no, not so fast. You have to first go through us before you can go and file your lawsuit. Classic, of course, has been the EEOC in our many Title VII cases defending individuals who were not accommodated in the workplace, who have sincere religious beliefs and convictions, against either a controversial experimental jab or having to use pronouns that are clearly in violation of their conscience and convictions. But we're going to talk about a case like that later on in the second half of the show. But it seems like this is part of the way it works, isn't it? I mean, where you have to go through administrative agencies before you can actually file your lawsuit.
That's right. And almost a daily basis, somebody at PGI, I think, is interacting with an administrative agency. So, you know, like it or not, we have developed that expertise. And so the good news is we certainly know how to work through that system. Right now I've gotten, I won't go into this in detail, but there's also a whole court system, air quotes on that, within the administrative system. So we also have, you know, cases on appeal going up through the administrative agencies as well. So it is a whole nother system. Some people call it the fourth branch of government, which is, again, as you pointed out, Brad, we have a three-branch system of government. So how is that happening? But the good news is the Supreme Court is poised to really prune that branch, if not lop it off.
Right. And that's something I'm really excited to see develop over the next few years. Now, what did the Supreme Court rule on this case that we're talking about dealing with abortion pills?
Yeah, the ruling here is important because it will explain why both sides are claiming victory. The court ruled unanimously, 9-0, Judge Kavanaugh wrote the opinion, that the four medical associations, the plaintiffs in this case that originally brought it, did not have standing. And that is a preliminary procedural requirement before the case is heard, what's called on the merits. So when we're talking about taking a case to the Supreme Court, very often lawyers will talk about finding the right vehicle, right? And that visual is helpful in this case, because before you can get inside the car, inside the vehicle, to look at the merits, to look at the actual arguments, to look at what we're talking about here, did they violate the FDA? Did they violate the APA? First, you need to have the right vehicle. And what the court said here is, no, this is not the right vehicle, because these individuals, these doctors, were not harmed. And if you're not harmed by the actual actions in question, you may not have standing to bring the case. And so the court did not reach a decision on the merits. They said you do not have standing in this case.
Well, it's probably very frustrating. You get a case all the way up to the Supreme Court, and then the court says, you know what, we can't even look at the merits of the case, really, because you got the wrong plaintiffs here. They have no direct impact. They're not specifically, uniquely affected by this. They just think it's unconstitutional. They disagree with it, but they're not directly impacted. Emily Mimna, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Keep it up, and I look forward to our next opportunity to connect.
Thanks, Brad.
At PJI, we exist to serve everyone in need of counsel, representation, and defense of their religious liberties, parental rights, and the sanctity of life. We don't take cases based on how high profile they are. We are workhorses, not show horses. Keep current on PJI's work on all the legal challenges we face on a daily basis by signing up for our Legal Insider email newsletter at pji.org. Now, back to the Dacus Report.
Welcome back. Now, I'd like to bring on one of our star attorneys who's done a lot of work before he came to Pacific Justice Institute, actually as an assistant district attorney. So he's been around the block a few times, and he's got some great things to talk about and share with us today, Attorney Milton Matchak. Milton, thank you for joining us today, and I'm so glad to have you on our team heading up our office in Stockton, California. Welcome to the program. Hey, I understand you have a number of cases that you're working on right now. I know one of them dealing with the COVID-19 vax and employees who had religious convictions against it. What happened?
Well, actually, there's a number of those. You're right, Brad. Good morning. One of the major ones now that we're working on, I'm working on along with Kevin and Matt of our office, is against a large Bay Area transit agency. It's coming up for trial early next month. We've been preparing our plaintiffs, talking to them, and also have been through some intensive settlement negotiations, and some of those have been quite fruitful. And we've been able to resolve in favorable manners for many of our plaintiffs, but there still are many left that are going to trial if they don't settle prior to. It's against an agency that decided that they weren't going to accommodate any religious exemption.
Right.
They required a COVID-19 vaccine mandate. Employees were given the option of filing for medical or religious exemptions to that mandate. And many of them did, close to, I believe, 200. No religious exemptions were granted to any of those employees.
Wait a second. Not a single religious exemption was granted to any of them at all?
That's correct.
Okay. And we're talking not just about one or two. You said 200.
Not quite 200, but in the high 100s, very high 100s.
Okay,
yes.
Gotcha. You're technical. I understand.
Sorry.
So a large number, and this is just one of our cases. This is just one of the 265 cases we have in active litigation. I think it's important for people to realize that when I talk about 265 cases, I'm not talking about that many people we're helping. We're actually helping many more people. Because sometimes just one case involves a large number of people that are being impacted, like this case against the San Francisco Bay Area Authority and Transit. I think this is an important case. Some of these you've already settled, you say, and some of them are still going to litigation, which is going to take a lot of time, I know.
Yes, correct. We started long ago, the trial preparation part of it, but it has been inactive mediation, and now there's still some hope that some will be able to resolve ahead of time. But if not, we'll be prepared and aggressively prosecute this case for our clients, the plaintiffs, and work hard towards coming out to a good resolution. It's in federal court, and the trial starts in early July.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that it's in federal court instead of state court. I think America is pretty fed up with the tyranny it's seen in a number of different state courts across the country recently. And it seems like federal courts seem to be a little more reliable, a little more reasonable, partly because of the many federal court appointments that occurred during the prior administration. So I think that's a good thing, even though it's at the district court level, it's often still more reflective sometimes of the politics of the locality. I'm hopeful that this will turn out well. It's going to take a lot of work, a lot of time. Milton, sometimes people may wonder, well, why is Pacific Justice so different in that we don't just cherry pick just a few of these cases? Why is it important for us to make sure that everyone's getting help, that no one's left on the side of the road?
Well, many times it's just, to put it at its basis terms, it's financial. Taking especially big agencies, big government agencies or large corporate entities or medical care entities to court is quite expensive. And Pacific Justice Institute does it for nothing, in essence, pro bono for its clients. And we are able to, through the generosity of our donors and supporters, take cases that might not ever see the inside of a courtroom, or at least any kind of a challenge to violations of constitutional rights, religious liberties that our nation guarantees, and that our laws, like Title VII, the federal law that protects religious beliefs in the workplace. None of those would see the light of day.
Right. And if they didn't, if we let some of these just get stepped on, I think it would have a terrible, terrible negative, shockwave of fear for the future, where in the future, if people are being having their Title VII rights violated, they may say, well, gosh, I better, go ahead and give in, because if legal groups like ours just cherry-picked and defended just a few, then the back of their mind would say, I'm still probably going to get stepped on and have no opportunity for defense. I better just go ahead and cave in and compromise my faith, my conscience, my values. So I think this is real important, because if we don't make sure they all get representation, then we're really not defending anyone's freedom for the future if they think that it's only just a few people that are going to be defended, and the rest of us are going to be put on the back of the bus and left for, you know, for who knows what to happen to them. So I think this
absolutely.
So this is so important what you're doing, and the fact that we uniquely work hard to make sure that people are not left on the side of the road and we don't just cherry pick. I think that's very, very important. And that's one reason why I encourage people, even if they've been turned down because their case wasn't pretty enough by some other legal organization out there, they should not hesitate still to contact us at our website, pji.org, to inquire to see if we can possibly help them. So hats off to you. This is very important. I'm glad to hear these cases are going well. When you say settlement, we're talking about people being vindicated and compensated, and you can't go into details. I understand that. But we have some very happy clients right now, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, that is as big a win as really, you know, winning in court. Courts, when you win in court, you set precedents that can be used in other court cases. But, you know, for many of our clients that are, you know, sort of risk adverse, they're very happy that they've been able to resolve them outside of the courtroom and walk away with a settlement that is satisfactory to them, but also, you know, addresses the issues that they had without going through the stress and length of litigation. And many times, Brad, we've been able to help people, especially in a Title VII context, in the EEOC process, prior to even filing for litigation. We've been able to help them before the EEOC, writing letters for them, advising them, helping them during mediation in the administrative stage, which, you know, ends many times favorably for them, far short of the lengthy and stressful court process. So we do that also, which has been very helpful. And I've enjoyed that process very many, many times, helping clients through mediation with an EEOC mediator, helping them with letters, advising them on how best to approach their EEOC, and I'm talking about the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, challenges that they filed against their employer for religious discrimination.
Right.
And that's how many of these begin when it comes to Title VII cases.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's important for people to understand that, you know, the EEOC is big, and their job is to take on these cases themselves. But I think people don't realize the enormity of what we do, in that we have several times the number of cases that we have taken on for religious people, religious accommodation under Title VII, versus what the EEOC, the big federal agency, is doing. We are really taking on, helping a lot of people, several times the number of the EEOC. I was really surprised and encouraged when our chief counsel, Kevin Snyder, released that to us this last week. But needless to say, we're working hard, and you're one of those key players. I'd like now to shift, if I may, for the sake of time, to something very important. I know people want to hear about this. It's involving a constitutional civil rights case against a charter school on behalf of a public school teacher who doesn't like the idea of lying to parents. Please tell me more.
Yes, that was here in California. I worked along with our deputy chief counsel, Matt McReynolds, on that case on behalf of the educator at a public school, a public charter school. Matt filed a discrimination case charging First Amendment freedom of religion allegations, Title VII. It involved a educator that, because of her religious convictions and her Christian belief, she couldn't call a little girl that wanted to be called a little boy, call him a boy, something that they obviously weren't. She couldn't lie to the parents about the gender confusion that their children were going to. She couldn't misgender them through the use of inaccurate pronouns. And it came in conflict with the administration at the charter school she was working with, to the point where they denied all accommodations. She was willing to call them classmates or call them by their last name or using some sort of a gender neutral terms for them. This was just her Christian religious faith that prevented her from, lying basically to children and to to their parents. And because of that, she faced a hostile environment at the school, which eventually led to her firing.
Right. Yeah. Milton, keep up the great work, and God bless you, as you continue the fight.
God bless you, Brad.
We would love the opportunity to continue to serve you. Just visit pji.org and click the Legal Insider button to sign up for our email newsletter. At PJI, we help individual employees, employers, business owners, pastors, students, citizens of every stripe through our practical resources, counsel, representation, and defense, all free of charge at pji.org. PJI is an island of stability and assurance in our ever-churning sea of legal and societal chaos. We are here for you.
So folks, just remember, it's our God-given freedoms we're talking about. Now, let's choose to keep them. I'm Brad Dacus, president of the Pacific Justice Institute. Let's continue the fight for your freedoms.